Welcome to Writing the Wrong Way. We talk about writing works, how writers work, and why the best writers risk being strange. And I want to spend some time talking about one of the best writers, Shirley Jackson, and her novel, The Haunting of Hill House. I read this novel again every year. When I first read this novel, I hated it, by the way. I just didn't get the hype. It just seemed kind of whatever, you know? Like, just seemed overhyped to me. I didn't really understand what was supposed to be so great about it. It just didn't really grab me for whatever reason. I read it when I was in high school. And then for some reason, I reread it again years later. I don't know why I decided to reread it again. It might have just been because I had heard it discussed so much in the, you know, course of my degrees that I just would... Nobody would ever really talk about it. I never had it assigned to me. No one ever really seemed to be reading it anymore, but it would always turn up in essays as kind of an offhand mention. And then I stumbled across a edition of it at a garage sale or a thrift store one day. And it was a special edition where Stephen King, I guess, for a brief period had this deal with some publisher where he was putting out the Stephen King library. So these were just classic books that were just being repackaged with introductions by Stephen King. And I found The Haunting of Hill House there and I bought it and I was just blown away. So I read King's introduction, you know, because I was just more interested in King actually than Jackson at that time. And King had mentioned the book elsewhere. But then I bought this, I read this introduction and I was just blown away by what King seemed to be saying about this book. I thought, well, maybe it's time to give Hill House another chance. So I read it, and it is, I would say, one of the few books that I consider pretty much perfect. It's really, really, really difficult for me to spot even one bad moment. There's not one thing, and every time I reread it, I think to myself, this time I'm going to catch something. You know, this time I'll find Jackson making a mistake or, you know, just something that I don't quite think is working. But every time I walk away from the book, just more impressed by it rather than less. And I teach it a lot. I think it's a fascinating book for writers to look at, particularly because it does two things incredibly well. Three things incredibly well. One, though, is this character, the main character, Eleanor Vance. Eleanor is, I think, one of the most fascinating characters in literature. She's one of the most interesting characters. She's not necessarily a sympathetic character, which I think is interesting. So the book is sort of a masterclass in some ways in how to write a character who isn't necessarily likable. One of the first things we're told about Eleanor is how is something to make us not like her. Although we might, she's such an interesting character. She's drawn so interestingly in the first early pages of the book. And the other characters are quite interesting as well. The whole cast is interesting. This whole idea of getting a bunch of people together in a haunted house is sort of an innovation by Jackson here as well. And of course, that's been copied so many times in so many poor ways. Jackson really has a brilliant take on how these characters are interacting with one another. She really can draw Eleanor as a character in a fascinating way. It's a masterclass on Eleanor Vance and how to create a character. The book does other things very well, but so I'm going to kind of talk in two episodes here about The Haunting of Hill House. But this first episode is all focused on Eleanor Vance and the kind of characterization of Jackson's approach. We're going to dive into that. I hope if you like The Haunting of Hill House, or if you like this discussion of The Haunting of Hill House, if it's, you know, it kind of helps you get a grasp of how you might write your own characters, or even just if you just, aren't a writer but are interested in this book, I hope that you will go to strangeink.ca and sign up for my newsletter, where I'll make some more recommendations. I'll give you some more writing tips. I'll just tell you what's going on with me, share my drafts and what I'm working on, and you can reply to it. It goes right to me. You can tell me what you think of Hill House. We can, keep in touch this way. Strangeink.ca again is where you sign up to my newsletter, and the best way for you and me to keep in touch. Forget Musk, forget Zuckerberg, forget all the other things that are out there in the social sphere, where they want us to look at ass and they want our eyeballs. Let's just kind of circumvent all that and talk about Shirley Jackson and get on each other's emails here a little bit. But without further ado, let's discuss The Haunting of Hill House. Thing to consider, this is my version of the book. You might have a different version, different page numbers, so I'm not going to note page numbers, but I'll tell you roughly where things are in the book. I'm going to read a few passages from this book that indicate early on our introduction to Eleanor Vance. Who is Eleanor Vance? Fundamentally, this is the thing we need to think about when looking at Hill House, because it is, as we see, of course, inextricably tying itself to Eleanor Vance, at least out of the characters in this story. It is Eleanor herself who becomes the core victim of the house. Now, I want on one hand to note that this is a trope of the horror story, in particular the haunted house story. When we're looking at a horror story, we're looking at a haunted house story. Again, that's a subgenre of horror. And there are things that are conventions in the haunted house story, which we see in other, things that we see in other stories. And then there are things that are moving against the conventions. So you always have these conventions, these ways that things are normally done in a certain type of story. And then you'll have individually in stories, stories as a group, haunted house stories as a group will have certain conventions, things that you almost always see. But then individually in each story, it will or will not conform to the conventions. And when things are following conventions, when stories are doing the things that those types of stories normally do, we call those conforming to the conventions. Otherwise, though, what we'll see in instances is the author subverting the conventions. So actually intentionally moving against what is normally done in this horror story. So there's a level at which the genre is interesting and worth thinking about here. The author has to fulfill a certain number of the conventions for this to be a haunted house story. So it isn't that you can throw all of the conventions, all the ways things normally get done out the window. You have to do a certain minimum amount of them to have a horror story, to have a haunted house story. But there, of course, is this scenario where if the author fulfills every convention, does all the things that we expect in a haunted house story, we'll maybe be dissatisfied by that. It's too predictable. It's too obvious. We've seen other stories like this. There's nothing unique here. Authors always pick and choose, at least a good author will pick and choose what conventions they're going to conform to and what conventions they're going to subvert or overturn. And this is where you get surprise in a haunted house story. The audience, reading that story has a certain awareness of what is normally done in the story. And so you surprise them when you don't do those things. Now, it's where it's just iterating a few of the conventions of the haunted house story that Jackson is conforming to. So one, there's a house, right? Hill House, in this instance. This house has a reputation for being haunted. So it's a house that people believe is haunted. It is a house that appears very much to be haunted insofar as unusual or strange things are happening there. So we have a certain point, of course, the Excuse me. We have the convention of writing on the walls, you know, writing appearing on the walls. It's unclear what exactly is happening in that scene, but we have in one instance, you know, what appears to be chalk appearing on the walls, and then we have another instance what appears to be red paint. But of course, you know, we can imagine blood, right? Red paint or blood appearing on the walls of Hill House. Now, we'll talk about that later in another video, but it is worth pointing out that that is a common thing that we see in, you know, the haunted house story, like writing appearing on the walls and blood or something like blood. We have the idea that the house is haunted. Again, we have this mystery around its construction, right? Which is a common trope in the house, haunted house story. The idea that somehow from its very inception, perhaps this house had become haunted. There are basically two types of haunted house stories in a nutshell. One is the house that itself is wrong, you know, the house that's built on the ancient burial ground, or the house that, you know, just is something wrong with it from its inception, which is we seem to have in Hill House here. Perhaps there's a suggestion that it was constructed with occult angles. There's a suggestion that the workers refused to work on it and, you know, left rather than complete it in a timely manner, and they had to bring new workers in and so on. There's all sorts of things that have to do with the house being constructed and how it was always seems sort of strange or unusual from its inception, which is a type of haunting house story. The house that was always wrong. Again, you typically the house that was built on the burial ground or what have you. We don't have that situation exactly, but you have that sort of idea. Then there's the house that becomes haunted. You know, the house that is normal until a thing happens in the house, you know, murder takes place or what have you, and a ghost, somebody dies in the house and starts to haunt it. Right. So here we have options for that. We have, of course, you know, the person who built the house, you know, members of his family have died in the house in mysterious circumstances or on the grounds because of a car accident, because of suicide, you know, for other reasons. So we have a number of different people who have died in or near the house who could haunt it. We have people who maybe didn't die in the house, but could reasonably be assumed to haunt it, given that they had a strong tie to it in life. And then we have the suggestion the house is maybe just wrong always, wrong from its inception, wrong from because it was constructed a certain way or for no apparent reason that anybody knows. We have the idea that Hill House, you know, among these hills, maybe there's something wrong with that place. It's very, we have a lot of the common tropes, a lot of the conventions around what normally haunts a house are available for us. All the standard ghosts, all the standard reasons why a house might be haunted. But what is subverting the convention here is that we don't actually ever find out what haunts Hill House. The narrator doesn't really know what haunts Hill House exactly. We never really find out what haunts Hill House. We have all these options, but we don't have confirmation that any of these reasons is why Hill House is haunted. We don't even really have true and strong evidence that it is haunted. Everything that happens in the house is more or less something that people are perceiving. But we do have sort of this level at which the narrator suggests that whatever walks there walks alone. So it's very unusual and subverting conventions insofar as it is pushing against settling into what is the ghost, which is a very common point in the horror story. The haunted house story almost always hits the point where we now know what is happening. We didn't know for a while, and then we now know what is the reason, what is the haunting, what is the cause of the haunting. Now, the other thing to note here in terms of fulfilling a subverting conventions, again, so far as things tie to Eleanor, it is classical and conventional that the house has singled out one of these people inside of it to be its first primary victim. So it's very common in a haunted house story that you have multiple people in a house and one of them will be the one that the house picks and starts to target phenomenon at. you know, the one who suspects that something is wrong here, whereas the others disbelieve it. The one that sees more strange things has more strange things kind of happen to them. And the others don't see those things, don't, you know, believe what is going on. This sort of singling out of an individual as a target of the haunting before the haunting widens out to encompass the other characters is something we do see here. We have, you know, other characters kind of being wrapped up in it, but clearly Eleanor, you know, is the focus, the focal point. Eleanor is the one the house wants. That's obvious. And that is a very conventional thing. One, that the house will, that the haunting, whether it's a ghost or what have you, the haunting, typically the ghost in the haunted house story will select the person in the house who is somehow tied to the ghost. Either, you know, a really conventional thing they would have, but again, a way that Hill House is subverting a convention. Normally in these haunted house stories, you'll have a character like Luke, who is the one who has a familial tie to the people who own the house. You know, Luke owns the house. His family has owned the house forever. You know, he goes in back in a line, to the original owners of Hill House. But Luke, unlike most haunted house stories, this person with the familial tie, this person who has this, you know, land stake, who owns the property, is not the person who is targeted by the haunting. Typically, the ghost or the haunting will target the person who has a familial tie to the past, to why this place is haunted. And it'll often be some aspect of revenge in the typical story. We don't have that here. You know, Eleanor, who does not have a familial tie to the house, is instead the one who gets targeted. So on one hand, there's a fulfilling of a convention. You're targeting one individual more than the others. On the other hand, we have a subversion of the convention in that the person with the familial tie is not being targeted. It is a convention also in the horror story that women are targeted and are the subject of the hauntings. They typically are gendered in this way. Women typically and conventionally are the ones who the house or the ghost targets and victimizes either first or most fully. We see that to some degree in the Yellow Wallpaper, if in fact it's a supernatural story. If we don't want to call it a supernatural story, we can still look to other stories where we see that same trajectory, a haunting that targets primarily the woman in the house before the others, you know, who's seen as more sensitive to a supernatural phenomenon for whatever reason. Typically because the ghost themselves is a murdered woman. This is the conventional thing that we'll see. And then it therefore targets, the ghost will target the person most like themselves and try to, you know, take possession of that person. You know, it's very typical to have that trajectory in a haunted house story where the, again, if you want to regard the Yellow Wallpaper as a haunted house story, we could see something like this happening where the person who is haunting, you know, the woman haunting is trying to take possession of a woman like themselves and sort of get a second, you know, chance at life or having a body or having control. Now, we don't have a clear sense of what's going on in Hill House or what's haunting it, but I think it is fair to say that by the end, we do have this idea that Eleanor has to some degree been taken possession of, or at least Hill House has worked on her thoughts. It's taken, if not full possession of her body, it's worked on her mind, and it is getting her to do the things that it wants her to do, as opposed to maybe what is best for herself or what she might be thinking about doing herself. So by the end of the story, for example, we have that those the moments where she's crashing into the tree, which we'll investigate a little bit more fully in another video. But in those moments, it's very plain to see that Eleanor does not seem fully in control of herself. When we're first introduced to Eleanor, it's worth pointing out some of the aspects about who this Eleanor Vance is. So our real introduction to Eleanor is Eleanor Vance was 32 years old when she came to Hill House. The only person in the world she genuinely hated, now that her mother is dead, was her sister. She disliked her brother-in-law and her five-year-old niece, and she had no friends. This is owing largely to 11 years she had spent caring for an invalid mother, which had left her with some proficiency as a nurse and an inability to face strong sunlight without blinking. She could not remember ever being truly happy in her adult life. Her years with her mother had been built up devotedly around small guilts and small reproaches, constant weariness, and unending despair. Without ever wanting to become reserved and shy, she had spent so long alone with no one to love that it was difficult for her to talk even casually to another person without self-consciousness and an awkward inability to find words. Her name had turned, so I just want to pause here for a second. So let's just look at the personality of this poor woman that we've been told we're meeting now, and who is primarily going to become, as the story goes on, its main character. We start with kind of talking about Montague and other people, but really Hill House has selected Eleanor. We're told she's more or less 32 years. She's 32 years old and she's unmarried, so she has no relationship. At this point time, in this period that this book is being written, she'd be considered a spinster. There's a suggestion throughout the book that she possibly has, you know, some sort of queer desire for Theodora. She certainly has, you know, kind of lashed on Theodora as a friend, or possible friend, although Theodora doesn't seem fully to be returning this affection. You know, she seems kind of somewhat vicious at times. There's different ways to interpret kind of Eleanor and Theodora's relationship. You can kind of think what you want to think about it, and you can kind of look at the text and see where you kind of can find evidence for what you want to think about it. Certainly the whole possibility of a queer relationship is there and supported by the text, but it's never really a thing that gets confirmed in any real way. So, you know, it's interesting to consider and think about how that might affect how you read this book. The more salient thing that we do know for sure, as opposed to, you know, things we might speculate about, is we do know that Eleanor is a woman who fundamentally seems to have an inability to relate to other people. One, we're told it's because of this time she spent alone, you know, slash caring for her mother, interacting with only her, you know, very tight family. It's hard to believe that that would really be fully why Eleanor has no inability to connect to people. Of course, it would have been possible, theoretically at least, for her to have other relationships during this time. Even if not, certainly there's a suggestion here that she just fundamentally has a viciousness towards herself almost. There's a sort of meanness towards herself that she kind of gets into at times, berating herself for, you know, being foolish and feeling silly, you know, as she sometimes will call herself. She just is not a kind person to herself. And it doesn't seem that she's really fundamentally that kind to other people. She has a grudge against her 5-year-old niece, you know. You know, this is a woman who not only has nobody to give affection to, but I think it's fair to say is maybe it's hard to see how she might have affection in her to give, perhaps. You know, she seems to have, on one hand, be a very pitiful figure who has been sort of beat down by life in certain ways, or at least feels beat down by life in certain ways. And in other respects, you know, it seems... So on one hand, it seems like we can be very sorry for her, perhaps. And she's, you know, a person who is maybe very sad. And in some ways, you know, we might kind of suspect that perhaps, you know, she's not the most sympathetic person. You know, the first thing we learn about her is that she hated her. The only person she hated now that her mother was dead, you know, was her sister. So she has, you know, this absolute hatred of her family. It seems almost justifiable. You know, clearly her mother has kind of kept her under her thumb for more than just these 11 years. Her sister also seems kind of overbearing. Eleanor here has been taking it. Here she finally, you know, kind of does some activity and breaks free, but there's a certain level of sociopathicness to maybe what she's doing. But I think, you know, you can kind of argue about who Eleanor is precisely and whether we should feel sympathetic for her or, you know, maybe not. But certainly she seems to get more than she deserves insofar as, you know, becoming the target of something that just seems beyond her ability to deal with. She can barely deal with another person. She certainly is not ready to deal with Hill House. She's been invited there because, as we find out here very quickly, that when she was young, stones rained on her house. Showers of stones had fallen on her house without any warning or indication of purpose or reason. And this had happened when she was 12 years old. Their father died, and about a month into his death, you know, during her mourning process, these stones started to rain on her house. They rained for about 3 days, and then when they moved Eleanor out of the house, they stopped falling. Dr. Montague has taken this as a sign that he believes Eleanor is haunted by a poltergeist. He makes a distinguishment between ghosts and poltergeists at a certain point. He says, Montague later distinguishes between ghosts and poltergeists, saying, well, a poltergeist is this undirected force that, you know, can move things in the physical world but has no kind of mentality or consciousness behind it. Whereas a ghost, you know, he says, sort of has a sort of consciousness, it has a mentality, it has, you know, a direction in that sense. It has, you know, things it's trying to do, unlike a poltergeist, which is just lashing out in a kind of emotional way. But a ghost cannot affect the physical world, unlike a poltergeist, which can throw the stones and so on, make it rain stones. So you get an interesting idea here that if Montague is correct, which of course we don't have a lot of reason to believe, he doesn't seem to know that much truly about haunting. But if he's correct, and this is how the rules work in this story, we get the suggestion that Eleanor is haunted by a poltergeist and the house is haunted by a ghost. And you get the idea that the house wants Eleanor and is targeting her. I think an interesting way to look at this, and you don't have to buy this interpretation precisely, but I feel like one explanation for what is happening here is that perhaps what the house wants is for Eleanor to die on the grounds. Not because it has an interest in Eleanor, but because it wants the poltergeist. You know, here is the thing that the house can't do, affect the physical world in a strong and direct fashion. And possibly, you know, Eleanor has a sort of piece of the puzzle in terms of what the house needs or wants to do to increase its power. Now, that's a bit of speculation because we don't see really past Eleanor's death. But it is, I think, an interesting thing to note as, you know, the thing, the reason that perhaps Eleanor is being singled out. But let's push that aside for a second. You know, perhaps that's too much speculation. We do still, again, know certain things of Eleanor. We know that she has this great fantasy life. She, as she's driving towards Hill House, has this fascinating moment where she stops all beside the road and stares at this other house. She'd be passing and admiring a row of splendid tended oleanders blooming pink and white in a steady row. And now she'd come to the gateway they protected, and past the gateway, the trees continued. The gateway was no more than a pair of ruined stone pillars with the road leading away between them into empty fields. She could see that the oleander trees cut away from the road and ran up each side of the great square. And she could see all the way to the farther side of the square, which was a line of oleander trees seemingly going along a little river. Inside the oleander square, there's nothing. No house, no building, nothing but the straight road going across and ending at the stream. So she's stopping at a space where all these trees have been planted in a particular pattern, which suggests that they were designed to bound and go around a house, but there's no house there. It's just sort of this empty, uncanny space where it seems like a house is missing. And she thinks to herself, now, what was here, she wondered. What was here and is gone? Or what was going to be here and never came? And now, at this point, I'm going to continue to read the quote here, but notice what happens at this point. She stopped. She sees something that is actually the case, you know, the strange sort of thing that she sees on the side of the road. She stops the car, she looks, and she starts to wonder, well, what maybe was here, or what, you know, was supposed to be here, but they never bothered to build it. Then watch what happens. She moves into this fantasy world. She starts to imagine the answer to that question. Well, and look at the complexity of the fantasy that she constructs. Was it going to be a house or garden or an orchard? Were they driven away forever? Are they coming back? Oleanders are poisonous, she remembered. Could they be her guarding something? So she's got these kind of questions. She's starting to spin her fantasy a little bit. Then she just moves. This is, I think, a very important moment that really gives us a key insight into Eleanor. She moves really fully into this fantasy that she suddenly constructs. She starts to answer the questions that she just asked. Will I, she thought, will I get out of my car and go between the ruined gates? And then once I am the magic oleander square, note that it's magical now. Once I am the magic oleander square, find that I've wandered into fairyland, protected poisonously from the eyes of people passing. So now note the fantasy here. The fantasy is a one of being protected by these oleander trees from other people. Once I have stepped between the magic gateposts, will I find myself through the protective barrier, the spell broken? She's still asking questions like, will this happen? Will this happen? Now she turns and she starts to make statements. I will go into a sweet garden with fountains and low benches and roses trained over arbors and find one path, jeweled perhaps with rubies and emeralds, soft enough for a king's daughter to walk over with her little sandaled feet. She's a king's daughter now, right? She's a princess in this imagination. She's a princess being protected by magic from other people. It will lead me directly to the palace, which lies under a spell. I will walk up lone stone steps past stone lions guarding and into a courtyard where a fountain plays and the queen waits, weeping for the princess to return. She will drop her embroidery when she sees me and cry out to the palace servants, stirring at last after their long sleep, to prepare a great feast because the enchantment has ended and the palace is itself again. And we shall be live happily ever after. It's this strange, you know, over the top fantasy she constructs. And then she starts to back away from it. You think, she says, no, of course, she thought, turning to start her car again. And then this is a bit of a trick. You think, oh, well, she's coming back to her senses. She's just, you know, has been fancying this, you know, indulging herself in a little fantasy. And now, you know, she's going back in her car and going back to the normal world. But note what happens here, though. No, of course, she thought, turning to start her car again. Once the palace becomes visible and the spell is broken, the whole spell will be broken. And then all this countryside outside the oleanders will return to its proper form, fading away, towns and signs and cows, in a soft green picture from a fairy tale. Then, coming down from the hills, there will be a prince riding, bright and green and silver, with 100 bowmen riding behind him, pennants stirring, horses tossing, jewels flashing. She goes deeper into the fantasy. You think that she's going to retreat, but she goes deeper into it. And now note what's happening here. She is driving towards Hill House. She stops and sees a place where there is no house. And she imagines going into it and returning home. The fantasy she has is that she is returning home. She is coming back as a princess to the place, to her kingdom, to the place where she belongs. It's this fantasy of belonging. You know, before she gets to this house, she is so primed to become its victim. She wants so much to belong somewhere, anywhere, even Hill House. And it's very curious as the story goes on, and I think in some ways very sad that Eleanor, you know, is so oblivious in some respects to what is happening here. She's so oblivious. She's so ready to be its victim because she has just never really known kindness. She can't give it. She doesn't know it. There's this level at which she just is expecting something from the world that it can't give. And she's expecting something from Hill House that it knows it can terrorize her with. There's a great little scene right after this one where she has another kind of interesting moment where she stops at a roadside diner, country restaurant. She's sitting and she sees this little girl across the little way across the room. And the little girl, the only other people in the dining room were a family party, a mother and a father with a small boy and a girl. They talked to one another softly and gently. And once the girl turned and regarded Eleanor with frank curiosity, and after a minute smiled. The lights from the stream below touched the ceiling and the polished tables and glass along the little girl's curls. And the little girl's mother said, "She wants her cup of stars." Eleanor looked up surprised. The little girl was sliding back in her chair, suddenly refusing her milk. While her father frowned, her brother giggled, and her mother said calmly, "She wants her cup of stars." "Indeed, yes," Eleanor thought. "So indeed, so do I. A cup of stars, of course." So now, you know, she's like identifying now with this little girl. All of a sudden, she's got an identification with this little girl. She wants this cup of stars just like this little girl wants her cup of stars. She doesn't know what the cup of stars really refers to, but she's kind of in a symbolic world, what she wants. You know, she's been thinking about what she wants as she goes to Hull House, and here it is symbolized. She wants her cup of stars. "Her little cup," the mother was explaining, smiling apologetically at the waitress who was thunderstruck at the thought that the mill's good country milk was not rich enough for this little girl. "It has stars in the bottom. She always drinks her milk from it at home. She calls it a cup of stars because she can see the stars while she drinks her milk." Waitress nodded, unconvinced, and the mother told the little girl, "You'll have your milk from your cup of stars tonight when we get home. But just for now, just to be a good little girl, will you take a little milk from this glass?" And now, note the reaction here. It's a very... I think a brilliant moment that Jackson has put in here, because it gets you deep into who Eleanor is. And I think it really is maybe the moment that ties you to Eleanor the most. "Don't do it," Eleanor told the little girl. So this is just in her head. She's thinking this. It says Eleanor told, but do kind of note something here. The verb told. So we have her think, "Don't do it," but the story says Eleanor told the little girl. So she's imagining telling this girl. But do keep in mind that we have the suggestion in this story that Eleanor perhaps has some supernatural phenomenon. It is not without beyond reason to suggest that maybe Eleanor can kind of think and communicate with this girl. Certainly Theodora, we're told, can do those things. We don't know whether to believe it. And there's moments where Theodora does seem to kind of know what Eleanor is thinking, but it's hard to say. Anyway, it's a bit of speculation again, but again, look at the moment, what Eleanor thinks here. "Don't do it," Eleanor told the little girl. "Insist on your cup of stars. Once they have trapped you into being like everyone else, you will never see your cup of stars again. Don't do it." And the little girl glanced at her and smiled a little subtle, dimply, wholly comprehending smile. And shook her head stubbornly at the glass. "Brave girl," Eleanor thought. "Wise, brave girl." It's such an interesting moment because, one, it seeds very clearly the possibility, doesn't clarify this, you don't know this for sure, but it seeds very clearly the possibility that Eleanor does have an ability to communicate on some sort of, you know, supernatural level. But even without that idea, you know, these two girls understand each other. One, because Eleanor is a child herself in many ways. She has never really grown up. At the same time, she's kind of lost her childhood. You know, she's a weird position where she's an adult child who has never really had a childhood. But they trapped her. They trapped her into being like everyone else. They took away her cup of stars and she let them take it away. You know, she took care of her mother, who she hated, for 11 years. And now here she is, about to be the victim of Hill House.